I'm Jenny.
Hi, I'm Scott.
Welcome to episode 4 of the Reading Envy podcast.
Yeah, where we'll have what you're reading.
Today's guest is Karen Acosta. Karen teaches Spanish at a university in the South, and she is one of my very best reading friends, and so I'm very happy to have her here today. Hi, Karen. Yay.
Hello.
Hello.
Welcome.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being on.
Yes.
Yep. Very excited. What do you like to read? Just generally, do you like everything, or do you have some specific kind of area you'd like to focus on?
Well, I read fiction almost exclusively, mm-hmm. and just novels. I read in English now more than Spanish, but I've been kind of branching out lately.
So do you speak Spanish originally? That's your first language?
Yes, Spanish is my first language.
Very cool. Very cool.
All right. I've kind of switched over to English, reading in English now.
All right. Well, nice.
That must have been a process.
You know, it really was. I was very scared. You know, at first I didn't want to read because I considered myself a good reader, but I didn't know if my English was good enough. So I was really afraid to read in English, but then it was fine. You know, once I started, it was fine and I didn't stop. So
did it help you learn better English, you think?
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely.
That's great.
Cool.
All right. Well, through our fierce process right before the podcast, we decided that I would go first.
Great.
It was harrowing, but I finally won.
Came out on top. So.
What I wanted to talk about first is a book that I've been meaning to read for a long, long time. You know, it's one of those things, I really have no idea why I waited so long, but the book is called Pavane, P-A-V-A-N-E, by Keith Roberts. Now, Keith Roberts is a science fiction writer who passed away in the year 2000. This book was published in 1968, which is the year I was born. And it has a really good reputation. It's one of those books I just heard about over and over from people I really respect. And I just never read it. It's not even that big a book, but it's just always been out there. Now, Keith Roberts is known for this book and one called Kite World. I don't know if you've seen that one around. Kite World was written in 1985. And those are his two most popular books. I think I said he was British, but he is British. Now, this book is known because people always hold it up as a really excellent example of alternate history. And the central conceit in this book is that Queen Elizabeth gets assassinated in the year 1588. It's Queen Elizabeth I. And the result of that is that because of things that are happening in England and throughout Europe with the Protestant Reformation, that event of Queen Elizabeth being assassinated results in the Catholic Church surviving as is and becoming even more powerful and quelling all of the Protestant Reformation. So, but this novel does not take place during that. That's all prologue. There's just about a 4-page prologue that kind of sets this up. And then the novel itself is told in 6 pieces. So I think each piece was published as a short story. So they call it a fix-up novel or a mosaic novel. So each of them is standalone, all 6 of them. And they take place in the 20th century. So it's the 20th century in this world in which this change happened in 1588. So the world has a lot of differences. And the main one being that the Catholic Church controls technological development. And they can say yay or nay, thumbs up, thumbs down on various lines of scientific research. And so the world is very, very different. There is no radio, for example. They have these things called semaphores. One of the cool things I liked about this book is there were so many words I didn't know. semaphore is one I had heard before, but it's not one that you see very often. But a semaphore, for those who don't know, is they're towers that you can see the next tower from the tower you're in, and you signal, and then that tower receives a signal, and then it turns around and sends the signal farther to another tower. Mm-hmm. So that if you want to send a signal from a city to a city, there has to be a line of towers that are visible. Each one can see only one tower all the way to wherever you're going. Another thing is there's no like internal combustion engines. There's steam engines. So truck drivers basically run these locomotives on roads instead of on tracks. They're on roads. Excuse me. So that was all really interesting. But the most compelling thing about this book is how it was written. I found it kind of stunning when I was reading it. You know, it's one of those books where I like to read a paragraph over again because I thought, well, wow, that was really well written. So I'd like to read just two paragraphs of the second story. It's called The Signaler. So great. The Signaler is one of the people who run the semaphores. There's a whole guild, and the interesting, the guild is almost the only group of people that is independent from the arm of the Catholic Church in this novel, because they're so important that you know, you can't do without them because they're in control of all the communication. Anyway, so let me read this really quick, if I could. Again, this is called Second Measure, The Signaler. On either side of the knoll, the land stretched in long, speckled sweeps, paling in the frost smoke until the outlines of distant hills blended with the curdled milk of the sky. Across the waste, a bitter wind moaned, steady and chill, driving before it quick flurries of snow. The snow squalls flickered and vanished like ghosts, the only moving things in a vista of emptiness. What trees there were grew in clusters, little coppices that leaned with the wind, their twigs meshed together as if for protection, their outlines sculpted into the smooth, blunt shapes of plowshares. One such copse crowned the summit of the knoll. Under the first of its branches and sheltered by them from the wind, a boy lay face down in the snow. He was motionless, but not wholly unconscious. From time to time, his body quivered with spasms of shock. He was maybe 16 or 17, blonde-haired and dressed from head to feet in a uniform of dark green leather. The uniform was slit in many places, from the shoulders down the back to the waist, across the hips and thighs. Through the rents could be seen the cream brown of his skin and the brilliant slow twinkling of blood. The leather was soaked with it, and the long hair matted. Beside the boy lay a case with a pair of binoculars, the Zeiss lenses without which no man or apprentice of the Guild of Signalers ever moved, and a dagger. The blade of the weapon was red-stained. Its pommel rested a few inches beyond his outflung right hand. The hand itself was injured, slashed across the backs of the fingers and deeply through the base of the thumb. Round it, blood had diffused in a thin pink halo into the snow. And that's the end of... That's the first two paragraphs of that second story.
Wow.
But really, really vivid. You know, even more so than a lot of things, right? And the whole thing is written that way. I found it really subtle. There was times where I had to... You know, when I finished the story, I thought, okay, what exactly occurred? And I'd have to look at it again. And it was just almost poetic in how he brought each story to a close. And subtle is the word I'd use for this guy. I really want to read other stories by him. I was just going to say one other thing that's important to know about this book is at the very end, he wrote a coda. Okay. So pavon, the word pavon means a slow, stately dance, from the 16th or 17th centuries. I looked it up and I don't have it in front of me, but the word pavon is a dance. And then each story is called a measure: first measure, second measure, third measure, fourth, fifth, and sixth measure. And then at the very end, he wrote coda. So I'm sure, Jenny, you know more about what all those words mean than I do. But in the coda, he wrote, you know, and it's just something that I just don't know if I should reveal it or not, because I kind of want to be spoiler free, but it changed the whole book when I read the coda.
Oh.
Yeah, it's just one of those things where you're like, oh, you know, and I think he could have left the coda off and just not written it, but it was really interesting for him to write that. And I don't know if I should say more or not. I mean, maybe it sounds intriguing, and it should be intriguing because it really is interesting. You know, history and time and changes and things like that. So, but I highly recommend it. I am Catholic myself, so having the Catholic Church put in the worst light, which is the way it was shown here, is not something I enjoy. But it was a remarkable book. I really thought it was.
It sounds really interesting. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us like an example of something that was different, has been different historically in this reality since that happened?
Well,
back then?
It's really just pretty much all of history. You know, the 20th century is occurring, and they talk about the New World a little bit, but it's not the same. You know, the church is really the political power. It said, you know, half the world. So it just continued to expand and expand. And there were just little lines, almost, I think all of the stories in this book, in fact, I'm sure of it, they all happen in England. So anything that is talking about the rest of the world are just lines, you know, like there was a Pope Orlando, I remember, and he sacked Florence, Italy. So, you know, these are things that didn't exist. So there's always just these little things that just kind of come up. But everything's different. You know, it changed everything. There's no, I think if I remember right, the first story happened kind of in 1960s. And, you know, it's not talking about any presidents or anything like that over in the New World. It's all just a slowdown of technology. And in the 60s, you know, it's not that much different than it was. So
did you say the stories are connected in some way?
Yeah, they're all connected. They're all connected by being in the same universe, for one thing. But the second thing is that there's characters that are connected. And the first story to the sixth story, there's a flow of time there. So I don't remember for sure which story is which, but the first story is called The Lady Margaret. And in the fifth story, Lords and Ladies... there's like a descendant of those folks.
Hmm.
Does that make sense? So
yeah, so it's moving.
It's moving through time. Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. And one interesting thing that I noted, I don't know how interesting this is. I say, yes, you should find it interesting. But anyway, the ebook has the stories in a different order than my print book had. And I just happen to have a paperback. And
I
wanted to read it, so I picked it up on ebook because I wasn't in, I couldn't get at my paper book because it was in Utah and I was in Florida. So, but they're in a different order, and that's, I don't know why.
Hmm. Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Something else I was thinking about while you were talking about the book is that the word semáforo in Spanish means traffic light.
Oh, really?
Just kind of thinking about it. Yeah, the connection.
Well, that's cool.
I mean, it's the same word, but obviously different context.
Yeah.
So
I kept,
that's cool. Yeah.
That is really cool. I kept marking all these words, and there are words, some of the meanings I knew, but I just don't see these words very often, like susurration, semaphore, daguerreotype, arabesque, cudgel, cressets, conclave, not used as a papal conclave, but a different meaning. Discomfited, domine, thaumaturgy, rostrum, assiduously, and COOMBE. I don't even know how to pronounce that one. It reminds me of reading Gene Wolfe. I would imagine Gene Wolfe would have been influenced by this, but Gene Wolfe is kind of the same way. He uses a lot of older words that have kind of fallen out of use. And I think it gives a book a certain flavor.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And before I'm done talking about this book, I should say that I found a thrum in there.
Ha! Did you post it?
Yeah, I did, actually.
Yeah, that was the one you posted.
That was the one I posted, yeah.
I do this thing in Twitter on my Reading Envy account, thrum spotting, because I feel like everyone uses the word, but they only use it once. They tend to only put it in there one time if they use it. So
that's right.
Almost every book I read has it. So now I have to, I track them.
That's funny.
That's kind of a silly thing to do. But yes, there was a thrum. I'm actually looking for it here. Oh, there it is. Like the notes of organs that thrummed in his body until it shook with them and became a melting part.
Hmm.
Goodness.
To find out what that sentence means, read the book. Well, that's all I have to say about that. I think it's well worth reading. Another thing to note is that Neil Gaiman selected it as one of his Neil Gaiman Presents audiobooks. And there's an introduction on that audiobook. So Neil Gaiman thinks very highly of it.
Oh, that's good. Sounds great.
Yeah.
So, Karen, what do you want to share with us?
Well, it's very different.
We like different.
Yes.
For a totally different book. I just finished last week actually reading the book Admission by Jean Hanf Corlitz. And there is a movie made based on this book. Have you guys seen it?
I've seen it.
Tina Fey and Paul Rudd.
Paul Rudd, yeah.
No, I have not.
Okay. It's not a very good movie. It's not a very good movie. But it's one of the cases that this has happened to me frequently, that through a movie, I find characters that I would like to spend more time with. Even though I think the movie was not very good, I liked the characters. And when I read that it was based on a book, I went looking for the book. I actually read an article. The author was talking about the process of adapting the book to the big screen and how very, very different the movie ended up being. A different animal from the book. She calls it a variation and a theme. Oh. Once the book, the novel is not a comedy, which the movie is. And it's a 500-page novel. So it's a very, very different thing. But she was talking about how she was interested in exploring the double meaning of the word admission as something that you let in the case of, you know, college admission, but also something that you let out, like admitting to someone. And so she was, this comes from her personal experience. She was a faculty spouse at Princeton. And for a couple of years, she got hired as an outside reader by the Dean of Admissions to work on these college applications. And she started writing the book right away. And, you know, it's been kind of an interesting journey for me with this book, because I don't think this book would make such a mark on me, except it was kind of problematic to read it. I took it with me when I went home this winter, which in South America is a very, very hot summer. I took it with me because it was such a big book, and I thought this is going to be the perfect book to read on a long flight. And my book got water damaged in Buenos Aires. They left my suitcase out in a storm in Buenos Aires. And so the book was at the bottom of the suitcase, and the suitcase was soaking wet. Still some water in it, so I could not read the book. I brought the book back, but it's, you know, unreadable. So a while later, I got it as an ebook because, you know, I was interested in the story and I had started reading it. And when I finally got around to reading it, it was like a different book, because by then my sister was in her own process of application to graduate school. So it was kind of a very stressful and scary experience to read the book about this, as she was stressed out about this thing in her life. But I did not tell her about the book, but it made me think a lot, and it made me nervous for her, you know, and about all the things that you need to consider that she probably didn't know she needed to consider. But yeah.
Wow.
And you're involved in admissions in some way, right, at your university, the way I am, because you're a faculty member.
Yes.
Where it's like you're on the periphery, but there's kind of this pressure of, yeah, when everyone shows up, just to be wonderful and amazing, so people want to come back to you.
You have to be appealing. You have to be inviting. And then when they come in, you know. But the author was kind of taught, I was watching an interview of her, and she was talking about how she's, she is really puzzled, but not puzzled, but interested in the role that Ivy League applications or college admissions in general occupies in the what she calls the family tree of American obsessions. You know, she really wanted to dissect that, and it was really an interesting read. Although, like I said, for someone who's in the middle of that process, or knows someone who's in the middle of that process, is actually kind of unnerving. But mm-hmm. it was very, very interesting. I won't say more about the story because, I mean, there's a movie about it. I like the book much more than I like the movie.
Well, that's really interesting. Just yesterday, I saw a news story that said that Stanford is now accepting 5% of the people that apply. And there was a little bit of alarm about that. Okay. And they said that the difference between those who get in and those who don't is indistinguishable now. Mm-hmm. I mean, at least they're at the top, you know, 10, 15, 20% of people.
Yeah.
So. And when you're in the middle of the university game, that's what you want. That's what you're mm-hmm. aiming for, that you can turn people away.
Yeah. 95% of people that away. That's amazing.
Yeah, and I think it's good for the rating too, right? According to what the book discusses, like if you, that's why they recruit, and then they could turn more people away, but it's better for the rating. I mean, that rate of submission of applications to actually acceptance is what makes them go up in the rating.
Does the book get into what kids do to try to get in?
Yes, all of it. I would say most of the book is, I mean, the plot, it's a personal plot about her and her family and things that she's kind of hiding. But a lot of the book is just her reading applications and explaining the working, you know, and explaining the process of how do you put together a class of incoming freshmen, you know, and like you were just saying, it's the difference between outstanding and, you know, amazing is like tiny, you know. Mm-hmm. So a lot of amazing people get turned away, but she thinks, well, you know, they'll get in somewhere else and they'll have good life, so I can't feel guilty about this. But also the pressure that comes with that from all sides of things, like from parents, from the applicants themselves, from colleagues, you know.
Yeah, I imagine that's a lot of people to be disappointing.
Yeah. Really,
imagine
really
it would wear on a person.
She also talks about what happens after the letters go out, you know, and then for a few days you get the happy calls of people who, oh my God, they are so happy and they can't believe that they were accepted, and they send you cookies and they cry and they're ecstatic over the phone. And then after a few days that kind of dies down and the angry calls begin. As the people who got the
You've
rejections.
Ruined my life. Yeah,
exactly.
Wow.
Exactly.
Holy smokes.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds interesting.
Yeah, it was.
So can I ask you, I mean, you don't have to give anything away, but is the ending is the ending with the book and the movie, are the endings the same?
Are you referring to the thing that happened at work for her?
Yes.
Yes, a little bit, but they changed things. And not everything that happens in the movie happened in the book.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. But she does do the same thing and with the same consequence.
Interesting. That's so nebulous. I'm sorry, everyone.
But in the book, it is very calculated. You okay. know? She figures out, and maybe it's not a spoiler to say that she makes a change, you know, of a result that happened during the meetings where they were deciding who to accept and who to reject. She goes into and makes a change that she thinks will buy her a couple of days, but she's very, you know, calculating in this. She says it will take at least this time for them to realize, and this is probably enough time for all the letters to go out, which means they can't take it back.
Right.
So, too late. Yeah, exactly.
Wow. Very nice. Thank you.
All right.
All right, Jenny, what do you got?
Well, my first pick is Americana by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. I have no idea if I said that right or not. I think Adichie
is
right.
It sounded right. You're right.
This is a novel that's come out just this past year, and the reason I read it originally was because I am a member of an in-person book club in my town that's sponsored by the International Center. I think the official name is the International Center of the Upstate. And every month we get together and we read books that they picked once a year. They tend to be about different countries. They tend to be by authors from different places. Mm-hmm. And Adichie is a Nigerian author. And I have read some of her stories before, but never any of her novels, although I own them and hope to someday.
They're waiting for you.
They're waiting for me. And I've heard they're really great. So this was kind of my first experience with her in a longer form. And actually, this week she was named, this book was named for the shortlist for the Bailey's Women's Prize for Fiction, formerly known as the Orange Prize for Fiction. So it's getting an incredible amount of acclaim. It was on a lot of best of 2013 lists that I saw at the end of the year. But I wasn't ever going to read it because I felt like I'd read books by people from Nigeria already, and I'm trying to get to every country. And I'd read lots of books about immigration and the immigrant experience, which I really enjoy. But I felt like, well, you know, can there be any really new perspective of that? But I was actually pleasantly surprised because while it does talk about those things, it's more about the differences between being, and these are Adichie's terms, non-American Black and American Black, otherwise known as African American. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot in the novel about that because Ifemelu, which is the main character, she comes from Nigeria to the United States for her education. For her continuing education, graduate school, that kind of thing. And coming into the society with Black skin and having that experience, but not being from the United States, it's very illuminating. And the character herself ends up starting this anonymous blog where she can just kind of let people have it and be really honest and open. And she gets a certain measure of fame throughout the story from that. And gets known for her views on race and things like that. And I've seen some negative reviews of the book where people are like, it's just a platform for the author. She just wants to say what she thinks. But everyone in my book club was completely unanimous that everyone really liked this book. And I think the difference is that most of the people in my book club have either come here from other countries, being that it's the international club, or they've lived abroad and come back. And at the end, that's what this novel is about. It's not just about going and becoming an immigrant somewhere else. It's about what happens when you return to what you used to consider home and how you have changed and how home has changed. And yeah. I thought it was really just a compelling read. And there's another character in there that's kind of a main character too. Her boyfriend from Africa, Obinze, from Nigeria. And he has a harder experience. He's not coming for an education. He's coming to work, and he has to work illegally for a while. He believes promises that are made to him that were lies. And so he really has to struggle. And I learned from another reviewer that the word Americana with an H, which is the title of the book, is a Nigerian word. Used to describe someone who has lived abroad for so long, they no longer understand the nuances of being Nigerian. So that's kind of the nature of the book. I guess the last thing I'd say about it is what surprised me about it is that I took this book very seriously. I took it as a learning experience of things I should know about that I don't know enough about. You know, that's kind of how I responded to it. It turns out that the author actually thinks the book is hilarious.
Oh.
And I was really surprised.
How?
I saw an interview that she did with Zadie Smith about post-colonial lit. And when she reads the book, people laugh because of the way she reads it. I mean, not everything is funny, but there's some parts in there about the nuances of hair, like how people straighten and flatten and they throw all these chemicals in their hair, and how, you know, just having your hair the way it is naturally and whether or not that's okay and the message it sends and how complicated it is. And I don't know. I read it kind of going, oh, that's awful. That's so stressful, you know, and she's like laughing. So I guess I feel like I might have read some of it wrong, or I just don't have the experience that she has, the perspective that she has. So that was kind of startling to see that after and kind of maybe question my entire reading experience. But either way, I still liked it.
Well, you're just missing a little bit of the tone, maybe.
I think so. And the context. I mean, I didn't have the experience like she has had. So I guess I was more focused on wanting everyone to feel okay.
I think it would have been worse if you had laughed and the book was meant to be serious.
That's true.
So you're good. You're on the good side of that.
That's right. That's a good point. Good point.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's always weird to have anyone going back home after they've been gone for a while. I think everyone can probably identify with that one.
Yes.
Wow. Yeah, you're talking about Nigerian authors, and I don't know, is Nnedi Okorafor, is she a Nigerian?
No.
Because I read that on your recommendation, and I liked it.
Oh, Who Fears Death?
Who Fears Death, yeah.
I didn't know you read that one.
I did.
Yes, she's Nigerian too. Nigerian American now.
Yeah, so I'm an expert on Nigerian female writers.
Good job. I didn't even realize that was on my list for that.
I think
we get a lot of good authors from Nigeria.
That's neat.
It seems. Yeah.
Yeah, this looks like a book I should probably read. I know nothing about it, and therefore I probably ought to, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It sounds like something I would really like.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that I'm not from there, but I could relate to that coming home experience and everything. Yeah. Weird. So,
yeah, like where home doesn't feel necessarily like home. And
yeah.
Well, it's a weird experience. And oh, I forgot to say that, like, it starts near the end to kind of go back and forth between fiction and nonfiction, even though the nonfiction is also fiction in a way. Mm-hmm. But the author puts Ifemelu's blog posts in their entirety. And so they kind of are kind of like commentary on what's happening. Mm-hmm. I mean, not directly, but from the character herself. It's just, it's a neat kind of twist, I thought.
Cool.
Yeah, I guess that's all I have to say about
it. Well, very nice. All right. So is that me again?
Yeah, we're back to you, Scott.
We're back to me. All right. This one is probably less exciting. But it was exciting for me. it's a book called Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking by Susan Cain. Yeah, I read this book probably 2 years ago. I saw a TED Talk that Susan Cain gave, and I think it was called The Power of Introverts. I can't remember. But anyway, it meant a lot to me personally, and I just recently reread it or re-listened to it on audio, and it's a book that I wish a lot of people would read, especially employers, because it talks about, you know, what an introvert is. You know, there's a lot of scientific research and things like that, but I am one, so it's kind of personal. the way that a lot of offices are set up, you know, in a kind of an open plan, I guess you call it. Is that what you call it? When everybody's in the same room and everybody's got a desk and everybody can watch each other and everything. It's not a very good environment for an introvert who needs to be alone sometimes in order to do his or her thing. That's some of the things that I really got out of this book that I thought were really valuable. So I really, you know, I don't, you know, I could go on and on about, you know, introversion and things like that. And I don't really want to, but it's just something that, you know, I can't sit here and pretend that, you know, I'm in some kind of a discriminated class of person. You know, there are a lot of people that are way worse off than me, but I'm just saying that, the world is built really for, extroverts. And by that, I mean that the things that we value, are usually extrovert values, the things that we value as a culture. And, you know, can't tell you how many times in my life, you know, when I've been quiet or I don't say anything, at a party, let's say, and I'm sitting there not saying anything and my silence starts to make people uncomfortable as if I'm sitting there seething angry or something. Which is not what I'm thinking. It's just, you know, I don't have anything to say. So I just don't say it. You know, I just don't say it just to say it, which is just how introverts are. So, you know, a lot of things, you know, in school, like when they, group projects and things causes me stress. Reading this book was like, there was a lot of aha moments for me where I was like, so that's okay. That makes perfect sense. You know, and there were a couple of things that I learned that I said, you know, I should try that, and, helped me. So I just think it's a really valuable book, you know? So if you're an introvert, I highly recommend it. If you are an employer who may have an introvert on staff, and I think that's probably something when I look back on my work career, you know, like in my last job, I know that there was, I kept calling it chaotic. You know, this is really chaotic. I'm, you know, I can't do anything. I have to come in on Saturday just to get anything done. Well, now I know what that really meant. I couldn't even have told my employer, I need to fix this, because I didn't know how to fix it, you know. But now if I was there, I would know how to fix it. I would, you know, I need a private space. That's really, you know, that's all. One other thing that I wanted to mention, there's a book out called, has something to do with creativity. It's written by Ed Catmull, who's with Pixar. Do you remember that book, Jenny? Mm-hmm. It came in on audio. I've got it on audio and I started to listen to it. But anyway, Pixar is set up in a really wonderful way. Everybody's got their own private space, but all those private spaces open up into a common area. So I guess Steve Jobs set that up. And his idea was that everybody would have to run into each other whenever they went to anywhere. If they wanted to go get a drink from the kitchen or whatever, they got to go through this huge common area to do that. And they could discuss things in there. You know, they'd run into each other. They would communicate with each other. But then they would get to go to the spaces that they created, filled with whatever they wanted to be surrounded with. And it was a private space that was theirs. And they could always go in there, and that's where their work would happen. And coming from Steve Jobs, that's interesting because, you know, Steve Jobs, extrovert, right? But he needed Steve Wozniak, who was the introvert. You know, you don't hear a lot of speeches by Steve Wozniak, but you see Steve Jobs talking all the time when he was alive. Two different kinds of people, both super valuable, just different skills. Different temperaments, I guess is the right word, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's what I would say. So again, all I want to do, I highly recommend the book for anybody who deals with people, really.
So I have a question.
Sure.
When I took my newest position, I moved up into an assistant director role, and one of the librarians gave me a link to an article, something about the care and feeding of introverts.
Mm-hmm.
I think concerned that I was not one and wanting me to understand them. So if you had that opportunity, in a new job or in your current job, what would be, I guess, the number one thing in a list of wish list things? Is it that your own space kind of idea? Or?
Well, I think that your own space is really it, you know, because an introvert needs to be able to function. It's not like teamwork is not important. But at the same time, if I had a job in which I was with a team 100% of the time, like in this book, it demonstrated using some scientific research that when people are together in a group, it actually does the groupthink thing, and people can start to agree with each other and really not creatively do anything. So I guess what I'm saying is that I would need to have a personal space in which I could retreat to. And if we had meetings constantly, I think that would be a detriment. Again, it depends on what the job is. You know what I mean? I don't know if I'm being clear at all, but really that's really what it is a respectfulness of being quiet. Mm-hmm. And being alone sometimes and not being offended by that or thinking that someone is upset. I think that's the main thing I would want to tell somebody.
Hmm.
You know?
It's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And like I said, when I read the book the first time, it was life-changing, not in a major way, but I discovered a lot of things about myself that I thought, oh, okay. You know, and the thing is, you know, you can't live in a box where you're like, okay, because I'm an introvert, I'm not going to do any of this stuff. You know, some things are scary, but some things you do anyway. You know, you need to, as an introvert, you have to do some stuff. You can't just be, you know, there are super introverts or whatever that, you know, probably need to get out more. So I feel like I've gotten out quite a bit, but still at the same time, I've got to have that alone time. That's how I recharge my batteries. So, that's just how my temperament is, and it's not changeable. It's not something that you can say, oh, come on, you know, you can do this. Come on out here. You know, and that drives an introvert crazy. This one anyway. But anyway, that's all I really have to say about it. I just think it's a valuable book.
Yeah, I'd like to read it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially if you're in charge of some folks. I mean, just little things you'll pick up and you'll say, oh, okay, I understand that person a little better.
But that's important too, because you just think about how you often reward people for introverted kinds of things that they do, which may mean, you know, you're missing a bunch of other people who are not behaving that way that you are rewarding. So
yeah, that's absolutely true. And, in the first chapter of the book, it says that there's they don't know for sure, but they're saying about 30% of the public is introverted, you know, in some noticeable way, you know, so, yeah, one out of every three people you meet probably is not comfortable with some stuff. You know what I mean?
So you need to help them.
Are we all introverts?
Well, I definitely am. There's a, what's her website called? I just wanted to mention that. Thepowerofintroverts.com. And there's a little quiz on there that, you can take to make you decide if you are or not. And, you know, it's not like, you know, if you're an introvert, you need help. You know, please help this person. You know what I'm saying?
No, I think the book is saying the opposite.
Exactly right. It's saying
quit trying to make introverts into extroverts.
Yeah, exactly. And it's saying that there's a power of introversion, and it's using some scientific studies to show, you know, introverted people tend this, they tend that, and these are valuable things. So if you keep trying to pull someone out, that may not be the right thing for that person. You may be taking something very valuable away.
And Karen, you think you're an introvert?
Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah, and you're a teacher, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying that that's not incompatible at all. I'm just saying that a lot of people would say that it is, but it isn't. You know, I've been an actor on stage. I do a lot of that kind of stuff, used to, and it's not incompatible. So, yeah. Yeah. That's not what introversion is. Introversion is really how you recharge. I think the main question that I would ask a person if they were wondering is, when you go to a party, do you leave that party energized or do you leave it exhausted? And an introvert would say, I'm exhausted by that. An introvert is charged by alone or very, very small groups, like this one here.
Yay.
Yep.
I still don't know where I am. I always test all over the place.
Oh, do you?
Yeah, because my answer to that question would be, well, it depends on the party. So I don't really know.
That's great.
Well, take the test and let us know.
You bet.
Okay.
Yeah. And then let us know if you left today happy.
I won't talking take about reading always makes me
I love it. All right. Karen, what's next?
Oh, yeah. Okay. So it's my turn again. It's actually a short story. It's not all a right. book. It's called Casa Tomada by the Argentinian writer Julio Cortázar, and I did find a translation online. It's in English is called House Taken Over, and he's one of my favorite. Cortázar is one of my favorite writers. I used to read him a lot when I was younger, and I would say during my late teens and early 20s, and he's one of those authors, and then I stopped because he's one of those authors that they are so good. They make you angry because you realize you can never write like that. And so you kind of have to quit, you know. But I remember this feeling. I'm like, oh my God, this is so good. And it felt kind of giddy reading, and but also furious. So it's like a combination. But anyway, this is a story I read a long time ago. It's part of a short story collection called Bestiario. And it's based on a dream that he had in 1946 about a house. And it's inspired by an actual house, which is in Buenos Aires. And I guess just reading a little bit about the story online, I found the address of the house. And I really wished I had revisited this story a few months ago because I was just in Buenos Aires and in January. And I would have totally gone looking for the house. You know, I just didn't think of it. Well, next time. Anyway, so yeah, a mutual friend of Jenny and I's had a dream about a house, and she was kind of describing this dream, and it reminded me of the story, so I went looking for it. And it's interesting because when I revisited the story, it turned out that it was much shorter in reality than I remembered. You know, it was much bigger in my head, but the plot is kind of still the same, and I did remember the main parts of it. It's about a brother and a sister, and they are middle-aged. And they live alone in this huge house that the brother is the one telling the story. And he says that 8 people could live in the house comfortably. But they live alone there. And they like living in that house because it kind of holds all the lives and memories of their family, their great-grandparents and grandparents and parents and all of their childhood. But you get the feeling that they also – that he at least feels a little burdened by this because – and at some point he even says that he thinks the house is what prevented them from getting married. Like his sister rejected a couple of suitors and he had a girlfriend that, you know, they kind of, she died before they could get engaged. And so he's telling how they're still single in their 40s. Mm-hmm. And so the weight of the generations of their family, you know, and knowing that they, at this point they are the last two in this house. It starts like that, and he starts describing the house, and he very detailed about the layout. And actually, if you Google it, you can find the layout of the, like a drawing of the layout of the house. And he describes their routine, how he reads and she knits. They clean, you know, they get up at a certain time to clean. They cook, they eat together. And when they have lunch, they think about the house and the silence. And so they think about the house a lot. So at some point in the story, he says, this is how it happened. And it kind of changes completely. And it says that in the evening, one day he was in the kitchen and he heard a noise coming from, it's a house that's kind of divided in two. And there's a big door dividing the one wing from the other. So he heard noises on the other side of the house. And it doesn't describe where the noise was coming from or what was making the noise. So the source is kind of not revealed. It's mysterious. But he kind of, in a panic, he just decided that he needed to close the door, block it off, and lock it. And then he went back to his sister and he said, he just kind of very matter-of-factly declares, he says, I just had to shut the door to the other wing because they have taken over the back part of the house. And it just, you know, this just happened. And so the sister says, are you sure? And he says, yeah, you know, I heard it. And she says, well, I guess we'll just have to live on this side of the house. And so as the voices and noises kind of take over more and more of the house, their environment becomes smaller and they're limited, very limited space that they're living in. And it's interesting because it's like, you don't really know what the noise is. You don't really know if it's a real noise, actually. And maybe it's on his head, you know, it doesn't tell you. But he talks a little bit about like the gradual loss of things because they keep realizing everything. Something that they wanted or that they were looking for was actually on the other side of the house. And he reads a lot. He reads. And so the library is on the other side of the house. And so all of his books are there. But anyway, I just thought it was a it's still mysterious and vague. I still don't know what happened.
Wow.
But it's still a very good story. And it made me go back to looking at Googling the story so that I could find a map to the house and kind of figure out what he was talking about when he was talking about the layout of the rooms. I won't say the ending.
That's fascinating.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, you can kind of see where it's going.
Yeah, it reminds me of the turn of the screw a little bit. You're saying it's just totally ambiguous. And
yes.
And when you're done, you've basically got personal decisions to make about what happened, right?
Yes.
That's fascinating. Now, you're saying, if I heard right, you said it came to the writer in a dream, but the house is really real.
It's a real house.
It's fascinating.
I guess when he was writing, he was inspired by this house or the layout of the house or the description of the house in the story is that real house that he knew. And I found, I think on the Wikipedia article, if you look for it under the English title, which is House Taken Over, it tells you the address of the house.
Wow.
Which next time I'm there, I'm going to go find, I think.
But
you know,
there?
it's also kind of creepy. I mean,
yeah,
this was in the 40s, so I don't know, But yeah, kind of cool too.
That is cool.
So I'm excited about rediscovering this story.
Well, I'm looking at other things he's written. Hopscotch. I assume that's not...
Yes, that is a really crazy book.
Is it?
Yes. Yeah, it's a book that... I mean, it's just like that game, you know? You start and it's all out of order. All the chapters are numbered. And if you use... It tells you when you... start the book that you should start in chapter 76.
How about that? What's going on down there in Argentina? Isn't
he
Borges from Argentina?
Yes, he is. You get to the end of that chapter and there's a little number on the bottom of the page which tells you what number to go to next.
Oh, wow.
But it's a very different book because you jump around. I mean, what story are you reading? And so I had actually a friend who was very obsessed with this book in college and he had read it in many different ways. He had started the suggested order. He also read it front to back and back to front. And he said they're different stories. Different things happen in different order. The ending is different, you know. It's like you're reading the same material over
differently.
So it's very, very cool.
Well, very cool. I'm going to read this story and that book.
Yay.
Yay. Casa Tomada.
Yes.
All right.
Well,
and I can actually send you a link to the translation that I found.
Oh, that would be wonderful. So, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it says
it
was
it
this
too.
Story was originally published in Los Ángeles de Buenos Aires, mm-hmm. a literary magazine edited by Jorge Luis Borges.
There you go.
Oh, how there's about the that? Connection.
Yeah. Very cool. Yeah, I love Borges. I haven't read nearly enough of his stuff, and every time I read things, I'm just amazed. It's just so odd, and he writes reviews of books that don't exist, and they're fascinating. So it's like, what the heck?
It's wonderful. And I would say, if you like Borges and you like that quality to his writing, mm-hmm. I would suggest that you look into Cortázar as well, because he has the same kind of style of, this is so weird and so good, you know? And yeah, I think you really like it too. Yeah.
Interesting. Thank you very much. I love it. Yeah, that's totally new for me. I've never heard of him, so that's wonderful. All right, Judy.
Well, mine's about a home too.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it's Fun Home by Alison Bechdel. Bechdel. Is that how we're saying it?
I think so.
I forgot already. yes, Bechdel.
Bechdel,
it is a graphic novel. And I had read the second novel after that, or graphic novel. I've forgotten the name now. I have to go back and look at it. Are You My Mother? I read that one first. But this one was the original that she's so well known for. But the reason that I read it wasn't just because I'd read the second. I'd always intended to go back to read it. But this book has had some major controversy surrounding it. And it came out, 2006. So it's been out for a while. But this past year, the College of Charleston in my state picked this as their freshman read. And there were a few groups that were so upset that they took it to the state government, and the state government took money away from the college to punish them for picking this book.
Goodness gracious.
They took $52,000, which is, I guess, the cost of the reading program.
But Jenny, Okay, I have a question about that because I didn't know about this, but it is such a good book.
It is so good.
What was so upsetting about it?
They said that in choosing the book, the university was promoting the gay and lesbian lifestyle.
Okay.
And the College of Charleston is a state school. Yeah, and they ended up getting sent letters from, I mean, nationally, there's been an uproar about this. The National Coalition Against Censorship, which there are my buds, the ACLU, the American Association of University Professors, Modern Language Association, College and Research Libraries, American Booksellers, Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, the Association of American Publishers, National Council of Teachers of English, and the American Library Association have all said
this list.
This is not okay.
That's the list of organizations you want to have on your side.
Actually. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, anyone knows, well, I thought anyone knew, that when you pick something for like a freshman read, the whole purpose of it isn't like to indoctrinate anyone. It's often something controversial that will get people talking, because the whole point is to teach people how to start talking about things, mm-hmm. how to start being thoughtful, how to have different opinions in a group. I mean, that's really the hidden purpose behind a freshman read. So I've kind of felt like they definitely missed that as the point.
And this is such a good book for that, because a lot of the book is about her reading and thinking and literature, you know, and thinking about her own life in light of this literature. I mean,
absolutely.
What a perfect book for that purpose.
Because the central story is that her father dies and she thinks that he committed suicide. Her mother thinks he committed suicide, but officially that's not what happened. And so she is thinking back to her childhood, but she does each chapter of the graphic novel through like a piece of literature that she and her dad shared. And so it has some mythology in it. It has some Camus in it, F. Scott Fitzgerald. The importance of being earnest shows up there. One thing I learned about Bechdel from the other graphic novel I had written is that she is a serious thinker. Let me give you an example of something in a text bubble. Now, this is a graphic novel, so there are pictures. Mm-hmm. And then sentences like this. My brother ignored me, but looking back, my stratagem strikes me as a precocious feast of Proustian transposition, not to mention a tidy melding of Proust's real Alfred and his fictional Albertine. I mean, not your typical graphic novel words. And she always makes me feel like I'm never going to read everything or be as smart as her. So it's a good kind of reading envy type title. Mm-hmm. But I think we all do that. You know, you try to understand other people in your life based on like the TV they watch and the books they read and what they think of as important and what they're spending their brain power on. And that's the entire story of the novel, is her going through that process. I thought it was brilliant. I mean, it's just amazing.
Did you like it as well as the second book, more than the second book?
I liked it more, I think. Are You My Mother is very heavy on the therapy side of things.
Yeah.
Which just isn't an experience I've had, so I didn't relate to it very well. And she has this whole set of analysis, I guess is a better word for it. She's focusing very much on Freudian analysis and other types of analysis and the texts that go along with that in that book. So this one, I had at least read some of them. And so I could kind of understand the topics that were being related. Mm-hmm. So I enjoyed it and I read it and I was angry about the censorship. And then I went to read more about it. And if you guys ever get a chance, even just reading the Wikipedia entry about how she did the art in the book, it's amazing. She took pictures of herself dressed up as every character in the frame. Mm-hmm. And then she drew it in a very specific way. She added very intentional detail because she thinks you should think just as much about what you're seeing as what you're reading when you experience a graphic novel. So just the thoughtfulness behind it, I think, is really incredible.
There's also, maybe not very recent, but an article in the New York Times where she revisits her childhood home. And there are pictures of the house. So you could see, I mean, you will know it just from the book.
Yeah.
The wallpapers and the fireplace and the walls and the house. And if you see the pictures, you know that's her house. It's amazing how she drew it.
Right. And I guess I should say that Fun Home is kind of the nickname they gave the funeral home where her dad worked and where they lived. So not so fun of a home, really.
Wow. Yeah, I'm looking at some of the art. It's kind of amazing. It's amazing that she did it all. She did that and her and wrote it.
It took her. I don't. How do you know how long it took her?
Was it 10 years? It was a really
something
long
like
time.
That. She worked on it for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
She has a webcomic, too.
Oh.
So I think she fine-tuned her craft in that.
Mm-hmm.
But despite what the government of South Carolina has said, I would highly recommend this book.
The government of South Carolina. Wow.
Yeah, who knew that they were so interested in what people were picking to read? Astounding. They actually did this to two different universities this year.
Hmm.
And the College of Charleston actually had the lower amount that was taken away. The University of South Carolina upstate had a higher penalty for the book they had chosen. I don't have all that in front of me, though. So look it up. It's a great story to read.
Cool.
Well, Scott, would you like to share your number three?
Yes, my number three. It is Poetry Month. I can't believe I said that before you said it.
Wow.
Because you are the one who celebrates it. You're like, yay!
I do.
You were
and
like,
I bring everyone around with me.
You were like preparing for it.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, March 23rd, and you're like, 1 week. So,
well,
it's very
can I
cool.
tell you before you talk about? Can I tell you what I do?
Please, yeah.
Just so you can see how obsessive I am about this.
Uh-huh.
All year long, I read reviews, and if I come across a review for a book of poetry that sounds interesting to me, or if someone in Goodreads reads something, I mark it as to read. I mark it as poetry, and I leave it alone. And then in the middle of March, knowing that National Poetry Month is coming, I start requesting them from interlibrary loan and finding them in my library and making piles. And then I don't start reading until April 1st.
Holy cow.
Thank you. It's my new holiday. Okay, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, that's awesome. I love it. Well, cool. So I know very little about poetry. I've read very little poetry. But I do have a favorite poet. The first time I ever heard his name was from Joe Haldeman. I was looking up something about Joe Haldeman. He's a science fiction writer famous for Forever War and Forever Peace. He said something about Billy Collins, and he said, everything the guy writes is amazing. And, you know, I have no idea how he does it. And I was like, well, I should probably find out who Billy Collins is. So I did. And I've been reading him ever since. All the time. I have him on my iPod all the time. I've got a couple of, actually three audio versions of his stories or his poems. I'm sorry. And so the one that I picked was just the latest one. It's called Aimless Love. But it's really a collection of poems from other books of his. I don't know. He's got this famous poem called Litany. Have you ever heard of Litany? I'm not going to read that whole thing, but it starts out, "You are the bread and the knife, the crystal goblet and the wine." You guys heard that one?
And there's a cute video on YouTube of a little baby saying it. Like a toddler.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Yeah.
You can find lots of
it. So I highly recommend that. And he did a website. He was the poet laureate. I don't know if he still is, of the United States. And when he was there, he did a project, and I'm going to have to look it up and I'll put it in the post that goes with this, podcast. But there's a website that he set up. That's a poem a day, and it's not all by him. He was the poet laureate. So he was setting it up for everybody. So, high school students would have, you know, a free poem every day that they could read. And I can't remember what the name of it was, but for a long time I went there and I was just reading whatever came up. So he's just amazing. I don't even know, you know, I could read all his poems, but Aimless Love is a favorite. I think that's wonderful. But I want to read one. It's just called Love. And the reason I want to read it is because, you know, right now for work, I go back and forth to Florida. And when I'm in Florida, I ride a lot of trains. So this one really connected with me. In fact, the first time I read it, I was on a train. So, and it takes place on a train. So I would like to read it. It's very short. Hopefully Billy Collins will be okay with it. But this is Love by Billy Collins. The boy at the far end of the train car kept looking behind him as if he were afraid or expecting someone. And then she appeared in the glass door of the forward car, and he rose and opened the door and let her in. And she entered the car carrying a large black case in the unmistakable shape of a cello. She looked like an angel with a high forehead and somber eyes, and her hair was tied up behind her neck with a black bow. And because of all that, he seemed a little awkward in his happiness to see her, whereas she was simply there, perfectly existing as a creature with a soft face who played the cello. And the reason I'm writing this on the back of a manila envelope, now that they have left the train together, is to tell you that when she turned to lift the large, delicate cello onto the overhead rack, I saw him looking up at her and what she was doing, the way the eyes of saints are painted when they are looking up at God, when he is doing something remarkable, something that identifies him as God. The end. Love that poem.
It's a good one.
Yeah.
And you read it much more reverently than Billy does.
Do I?
Yeah. No, yeah, it changes the tone of it to me.
Yeah. He's very funny.
Yeah.
You know, most of his poems just have this wry humor that, when you hear him read the poems, you're almost always smiling, for sure.
He's wonderful.
He really is. He really is. So I would love, because of my really limited experience with poetry, where would a guy go after Billy Collins?
Oh, God.
Throw me one or two names and I'll start there.
I would read Ted Hughes.
Ted Hughes.
And, oh goodness, I just have so much in my head, it's hard to pick. Ted Hughes, yeah. And I feel like I read someone else that was similar to that this week, but now I'm just drawing a blank.
Okay. Well, if it comes to you later, let me know.
I will.
So again, the title of this collection is Aimless Love. And it's kind of I wouldn't call it a best of, although I guess maybe, but some stuff from his other books is what it is.
That's the one that has the poem about the mice that burns down the house.
I'm trying to remember which one that is. So.
I don't remember.
Yeah.
It's like it starts out nice and then.
Yeah. I know exactly which one you mean, but I can't remember the name of it. I'm looking at it, but I know right what you're talking about.
Hmm.
Yeah. Yep.
Charles Bukowski.
Ah, Charles Bukowski.
Yes.
Okay, writing that down too.
I knew it was in there somewhere in my head.
Okay. Excellent. So I will read some more poems. So I'm afraid I don't have much more to say about this other than I love it.
That's okay. Mm-hmm. You still have 20 more days of April.
But how do I build a whole pile of books in that time?
The library.
Yep. Nice.
You could read a poem a day.
There you go.
Mm-hmm.
I should do that anyway.
I recently signed up for a service that sends
every day.
Mm-hmm. Heck yeah. Sweet. All right, Karen, what's up now?
I have a graphic novel.
Okay.
Yes, no poetry.
That's all right.
Sorry, April. yes. And it's actually a series that I've been reading that I discovered last year at some point. And maybe you're familiar with it. Fables.
Fables.
No, Fables by Bill Willingham.
I've read the Rose Red volume.
Okay. I don't think I've read that one yet. Don't tell me what happens.
I won't.
Okay, I'm in volume 9, and I discovered it. I mean, amazingly, I discovered it late because that means I have so much material, right? And I am trying to pace myself and not just blow through the volumes. Mm-hmm. But after the incident with my book that got water damaged on the at the airport. It was hard to do because I had this on my tablet and a 12-hour flight. So I'm in volume 9 now. So, but the last volume that I read was called Sons of Empire. And basically just a bit of the background to the story is that these are all characters from fables and fairy tales that have been exiled because an evil character called the Adversary has taken over their worlds, their fairy tale worlds. And so they have been exiled into present day New York City, where they live in a place called Fable Town. It's basically an apartment complex in New York City, but they also have a farm upstate where all the non-human fables live. And one of the main characters for the series is the big bad wolf. He is banned from the farm because he has a bad history with a lot of those characters. And for this series, the wolf is the same wolf from all the wolf stories. So mm-hmm. he has a bad history with some of them, but he is a shapeshifter. He is kind of a type of film noir kind of detective, and he's the sheriff of Fable Town, and Snow White is the deputy mayor. And things like that. But it's interesting how they make all of these characters from different stories collide. You know, it's a great excuse to have them all interact and together in the story because they're exiled. But this has been interesting for me because it's making me look up fables that I don't know. You know, I am from South America, and a lot of these are not culturally familiar to me. So, for example, I didn't know about Rose Red. I had to look it up, and I had to read more about who she was. And I had no idea she had a connection with Snow White, for example. Mm-hmm. Another one is Little Boy Blue, which is from some nursery rhymes, I think. Mm-hmm. And I had no idea who he was either. He's one of the main characters also. So it's been kind of an interesting process for me just doing some research and enjoying the story. And in this last volume, the Arabian fables, their world is now being invaded. So they're going to also seek exile. And we also, no spoilers, but we finally find out who the adversary is. And it's interesting because it's a beloved character from a fairy tale that you would never think of as a mastermind, you know? It's getting really interesting. And the series is so clever. It's so inventive. And the art is just amazing. It's breathtaking. I probably spend more time looking at the page than just, you know, reading before I move on. But I also really like being kind of immersed in the genre. I don't know if it's a genre, but it's like books that are about books, you know, and where characters that you know and you like get to meet each other and interact. And it's also funny. So I don't know. I think it's a really good series. So yeah, if you
that's cool.
haven't read it, you should check it out.
I have not. Reminds me of League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. You know, all those characters are in the same one. But yeah, this looks way cool. The art is nice.
The art is really, really nice. And they have some artists that just basically do the covers. And they are like paintings. I mean, you can tell. They're just...
Wow.
They're just amazing, yeah.
So is he done with Fables? Or is it still going?
It's still going, I think. And I actually found it a weird way. I had read Fairest, which is a spinoff of Fables, where like all the princesses... that together, you know, and
how
I think
funny.
The first volume was, you know, the princesses, you know, are kind of hanging out, like I said, present day New York City. and then I realized this is actually the spinoff of this other series. So then I went to Fables. But I think it's still happening. I mean, basically it's, they do these, collections of, let's see. I think they have a little volume each month, and then when they get to a certain number, they publish a collection. So let me look it up. Yeah, but basically, it's really good. I highly recommend it.
That's cool. Yeah.
Sounds really good.
Bill Willingham. Nice.
I'm trying to think of why I would have read one in the middle, and I think it must have been nominated for a Hugo or something that year. otherwise I don't think I would have just started randomly like that.
Yeah, the last, look, there's one coming out in July. The last volume that's out was published in December 2013, and the next one's coming out in July, which is a collection of Fables, volume 130 to 137. So yeah, they're still coming each month, I think.
Yeah.
And it's been going since 2003, so.
And he's putting out a lot every year, it looks like.
Yep, yep.
It's impressive. So do you read them as ebooks or?
Yes, I have, and they're more accessible that way. But also, I really like reading these graphic novels in ebook format because you can kind of tap, and that the image kind of gets bigger, and you can look at details more than, you know, when you're just holding a paper book. So if you do a double tap, at least on my tablet, like using the Kindle app, yeah, you can kind of zoom in.
What device do you have?
Panel by panel. I have a Kindle.
Okay.
Fire.
A Kindle Fire.
I also, yeah, I have a Kindle Fire, but I also have a Samsung tablet, and I use a Kindle app on that, and I like to use that tablet to read these because of the size. It's just the screen is bigger and it looks nicer. And with a book like this that has such nice art and colors, it's worth it to do it on the screen, but.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah, that's.
I think I read the first two volumes in print, and my local library had it, but they don't have all the numbers, so I've been getting them as ebooks after that.
And then you can go back to them.
It's a little addicting, and the thing is, it's so easy to just click and buy the next one because you know so
yeah.
It's a blessing and a curse.
Like sold
exactly
sold. I love it. Very cool. Well, thanks again. Yeah, love that. All right, Jenny, what's going on?
Well, happy National Poetry Month.
Yay. I can't wait to hear what you selected.
I know, because it took me so long to figure out. I've read a different volume of poetry every day this
month.
Wait,
I have a question first.
Yes?
Did this selection change during the course of this podcast?
No.
All right.
Although I do have another one sitting next to me, and I could change my mind at any minute. No, I think I'm going to go ahead and go with this one. But, you know, if you want to read all my reviews, I'm in Goodreads. So
cool.
I review all of them. This one is called The Book of Goodbyes by Jillian Weiss. And I always keep track of why I add something to my to-read list. And this had been in the Publishers Weekly Best Books of 2013 list. It was also on the NPR's Best Books of 2013. So, you know, two lists listing one book of poetry when hardly anyone talks about poetry. Well, I thought it must be pretty good. And so I read it and I enjoyed it. And then I found out, well, she teaches less than an hour away from me at Clemson University. she teaches poetry there. So I didn't realize that she was a local Southern poet. I don't know if she's originally from the South. She is better known for her volume called The Amputee's Guide to Sex, which isn't actually that, but it's a book of poems. And she got a lot of acclaim for that, for writing really openly about disability kind of as a theme for some of the poetry. And that theme is still here in this volume, but it's kind of in the background. You just know it about her. And the best way I can think of to describe it, most of these poems are kind of about love and relationships. And she has a recurring character known in the poems as Big Logos. And does that strike any bells to anyone? It made me think of Sex and the City, Mr. Big.
Yes.
You know, the man she can't give up, and then he's bad for her, and he's good for her, and he's bad for her, and he's good for her. This character has that same kind of feeling to him throughout the poems, but I'm not saying that she did that on purpose or that she is like Carrie Bradshaw, but I just kept thinking of that because I rewatch Sex and the City every year. It's kind of a guilty pleasure. I didn't want to read any of the whole poems. They're kind of long. Not too long, but I thought I'd read the first line from one of my favorites called Be Not Far From Me, just so you can kind of get a sense of the tone. I think the tone is very casual. It's very modern. It doesn't try too hard. It's very conversational. I have a hard time sometimes with poems that take themselves too seriously. They want to talk about works of art or the mountains, but I tend to like things I can relate to. So this is just a silly first line. He called her number after many months and reached a man named Pete. So I just like the storytelling that goes on in these poems.
Well, that's nice.
They're cute.
Cute poems.
Sometimes you need a little bit of cute.
That's right. No question.
That's really cool. All I have to say about it. Right. Nice and short. Read poetry. Is great.
Yes, indeed.
So do you have a sense of how many books you have left for the month? Just for poetry?
I still have about 5 physically sitting there waiting for me. Mm-hmm. And then I have a book by Adrian Rich, who I think recently passed away and also recently won a National Book Award. I can't remember in which order. I think she was alive when she won the award. Anyway, I hope I'm not wrong. I hope you're not alive out there, Adrian. But ouch. It's a book, it's like her journals about writing poetry. So I want to follow everything up by reading that, and I think that'll take me a little bit longer. So it has poems interspersed with thoughts about poems. I thought that would be interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, I could really get into poetry, I think. I could. I don't understand the rules of it anymore. Are there rules? You know, when I read Billy Collins, it just seems like it's just, what they call it, free verse. Is there any real structure to it at all? Just kind of however he wants it to look, or is there something to it?
I'm sure all of these things come from somewhere. But like one of the books I read of poems was 100 Poems from 100 Years of Poetry Magazine. Mm-hmm. And they picked one from every year, but then they mixed them up so they weren't in year order. Uh-huh. It was really interesting to see the trends in styles year to year. Do things rhyme? Do the sentences end? Do, you know, things like that. I mean, I think poetry just goes through phases. And then there are some books of poems by the same poet where they pick different styles for different poems. So I think it's pretty open these days.
Yeah, interesting.
But I think it's important to just kind of, I mean, you can't force yourself to read something that you don't like. And I think in poetry, that's even more important. So there's a lot of books of poems I'll start and go, yeah, not my thing. No. Mm-hmm. And I just set it aside. But the stuff I like, I really like. Thank you for listening to the Reading Envy podcast. You can find us at readingenvy.com.